Good evening, everyone. I know we have a few more people coming into the public workshop, so I'm just going to give you a couple minutes to get to your seats. There's water and food over there if anyone's hungry or thirsty. And I am going to start. Thank you for joining us tonight for this important public workshop. And the purpose of the workshop is to inform you about the habitat conditions on Elwood Mesa, to provide you with an overview of the survey results, to explain the purpose for the recent trail closures on Elwood Mesa, and to describe upcoming possible actions to address trail safety and habitat management issues. The workshop format is starts with a presentation from a team of city staff and consultants, followed by question and answer. We do have a large team of city staff, not just us sitting up here. We have a lot of people here, and I'll introduce them later so that you can see what resources you have in order to be able to direct your questions to that particular person. But before we proceed any further, Sylvia Uribe is here to interpret this introduction so that any Spanish speakers are aware that she is here and available to everyone.
Muy buenas tardes. Y muchas gracias por estar aquí y por ver esta junta que se está llevando a cabo. Y el propósito de este taller precisamente es para informarles sobre las condiciones del hábitat en Elwood Mesa, para proporcionarles un repaso sobre los resultados de la encuesta que se hizo, para explicar el propósito de las recientes cierres de las veredas y también para describir las posibles acciones en relación a dichas veredas y al manejo de los problemas del hábitat. Este taller empezará con una presentación seguida por una presentación de los empleados de la ciudad, seguida por una sesión de preguntas y respuestas. Hay muchos empleados de la ciudad y ellos tendrán mucho gusto en responder a sus preguntas. Gracias.
Okay, so we normally, you know, workshops can be informal, formal. We try to balance out both here in the way we have this format. So I apologize for the formality of a microphone. But we are being televised, and we're doing our best to be able to capture the conversation and the question and answer on television. So your participation in that will be very helpful. We have a couple microphones that after we're done with the presentation. Oh, Andy's right there. He's got the microphones. And he will be bringing microphones so that you can ask your question and make sure that your question gets on the audio. So we really will need your help in making sure that that happens. I'm going to do a quick introduction to the team. Of course, I'm Ann Wells. And then we have Dan Mead. And we have Corey, our arborist. And then we have various people in our audience that will come up for Q&A. You already met Sylvia. We have Joanne is here. She is our Parks and Recreation Manager. We've got Public Works here, the Public Works Director and the Parks Manager. Our City Manager is here, Michelle Green. Our Neighborhood Safety and our Neighborhood Services and Public Safety Director, Vito Adamidis, is here. Todd Mitchell, who's our Risk Manager, is also here. Brett McNulty is with a consulting firm called Recon, and he's helping with the public outreach and various aspects of this project management. I see we have some city council as well in attendance, so that's always positive. So you have a lot of people here to ask your questions of. I see we also have some of our butterfly docents in the audience, and welcome to them and welcome to everyone here. Let's just start off with Dan Mead to start the presentation off with the slides. Oh, look at, they're all planned out. I'm not. All right, so I think I kind of already went over the topics in the introduction. So you can see on the screen, and I hope there are enough copies of the handout. So I should have also said, so the presentation that you're getting tonight is a shorter version of the presentation that was at Council on July 18th. That was much longer. It was a 90-minute presentation. Everybody can watch that. There's various links, and we'll have, I think there's some cards about how to get links to that presentation. But this is a little bit shorter because we wanted to make sure that you all had time for your question and answers. But we're hitting the highlights on the habitat, the tree health, on pests, what's happening with the butterflies, the trail closures, management, restoration, and then some more information. So with that, I am just going to turn this right over to Dan, and he's going to talk about habitat conditions.
Great. Thank you, Anne. And it's very gratifying to see everybody here. Thank you for coming to find out what's going on with our important butterfly groves at Elwood. The beginning of this work that we started this year came about when we were reviewing the conditions at Elwood last winter and saw the number of dead trees and the poor habitat condition on the site. And also we were tracking the number of butterflies out there. So any of you who've walked around, you know that the conditions on the site, which this slide shows a few of the issues there, have been very, very difficult, very hard on the eucalyptus trees over the last few years. This particular slide shows an area in Elwood, Maine, and the trees on the left are hiding the viewing area there at Elwood, Maine, the place with the logs where folks come and look at the butterflies. And the trees on the left, you can see those trees are all dead, the ones that are in the foreground in that location. And just to clarify, Corey will talk about this a little bit more, but those trees are not just injured, those are dead. Those trees are not going to recover. And we characterized all those trees out there and their condition. And that's the problem in Elwood, Maine right now, is you see on the right side, looking up into the canopy, on that photo on the right, a lot of those upper canopies are trees that are dead. You also see some regrowth on some of the branches, and that's, we'll talk about that a little bit more, and Corey can explain some of that as far as epicormic growth. That's the little sprouting that comes back. Some of those trees are still alive, and so the degradation of the habitat has been the dead trees, but also some of these other trees that are still alive, they're still coming back. But it's been a damage to the habitat and very difficult to maintain the same conditions that have been there over the many years at Elwood that the butterflies have been there. This is another photograph of a comparison between conditions at Elwood North. And just so those of you who aren't really familiar with those locations, I'll have another slide coming up soon, but this is the map of the Elwood complex of butterflies. And Elwood North is this site up here in this big grove. Here's Elwood, Maine down here. And I'll run through these sites a little bit more coming up. But this is up at Elwood North. This is a site that's typically an autumnal site, and a lot of times it has butterflies all year. And the difference between 2011 and 2017 is what you can see in these two images. That's the same big bush in the middle. On the right side is the conditions in June here. And you can see a lot of dead trees and a lot of open sky. And that's the result of a number of trees dying out in that location. Those of you who've been to the parking lot there and look to the east at that grove, you can see the huge number of dead trees in that location. So it's been a really serious dieback that's occurred in Elwood. Why did this happen? I think we all pretty well know the answer to that. It's primarily the drought that we had. And the combination of that and the increase in temperatures generally in California led to this enormous stress on the trees. These are just two graphs here. The upper one shows the temperature trends in California since the 1900. And that's about a 2-degree increase in Fahrenheit. That combined with the 5-year period we had was enough to kick a lot of these trees into severe drought stress and to kill a number of them. And the combination of that severe drought, increases in temperatures, all contributes to the problem that we're having in the grove. And blue gum eucalyptus are subject to drought. That's one of the trees that is affected by drought. It's not as hardy as some of the eucalyptus. And so that's what we've seen is a severe effect on the grove. The bottom trend is rainfall in that same period. And that stayed pretty flat while we have an ongoing trend that actually mimics worldwide temperatures here in California, as far as increases in temperature. So long term, that's a question that we have to grapple with as to what's going to happen. This is a slide that talks about epicormic growth. And to explain that a little bit is Corey, that I'll let you talk about that for here for a minute. And this is the re-sprouting that we've seen on a lot of trees. It means the trees are still alive, but they've undergone a real, real significant stress, and they're struggling to stay alive. They put out this type of growth. And I'll let Corey explain that a bit better.
Yeah, as Dan was saying, epicormic growth occurs when a tree is under a lot of stress. It doesn't necessarily just have to be drought. It could be over-pruning. It could be root damage. And luckily, eucalyptus trees are really good at producing epicormic growth. Epicormic growth are buds that lie beneath the bark surface that are triggered by stress, and that's when they sprout out. Trees, conifers, do not have epicormic growth like your pine trees and such. So it's really a benefit that these eucalyptus trees can resprout like this. It's a way of them sustaining themselves. There are some issues with epicormic growth, however, such as it grows out, it can form weak branch attachments, and so that means later on, as the epicormic growth gets bigger in windy conditions, some of those branches can snap off. And then, but it's a great way for the tree to sustain itself, and it's a great way for us to regain some habitat out there. And so that's our plan right now.
Yeah, just say a little bit more about that. Is that there are a lot of trees that are stressed. They're having that regrowth back. And my goal this year is to maintain all those trees, to keep all of them that we can, because some of those are going to recover really nicely. And they still provide habitat value for the butterflies in those areas. So my recommendation is not to remove any of those trees that are still alive, still have epicormic growth. And Corey, this is the tree rating scale. This is what we use to rate trees out there. We individually assessed over 500 trees that are directly associated with the aggregation habitats. And we have all the numbers on that as far as how many are dead and how many are rated at these different levels. And I'll let Corey explain the scale and also say something about the ratings that we saw out there.
Yeah, so as Dan stated, I went out with two other biologists and we assessed these trees. And what that consisted of was tagging each tree with a numbered tag and also taking the diameter, breast height measurement, and also the height. And then we entered that on a spreadsheet along with other observations such as pests that we saw or maybe fungal organisms or something that we might catch on the tree. But along with that, we assessed them with this rating system, and it starts at zero and it goes to a possibility of 10. I think all you've got the sheets here, but it was zero is deceased, should be removed. One is a dying or hazardous tree, should be removed. Notice it says should, not will. Two is distressed tree, poor structure, some pest, and poor health. Some may need to be removed depending on their importance to the aggregation site. Three is a tree with some pest, minor structural defects that can be mitigated, could stay. Four is a tree with minor structural defects and overall good health, could stay. Five is a relatively healthy tree that can be left in a natural state. And we didn't find anything above a four. Numbers 7 through 10, I didn't expect to see anything like that out there because those are usually maintained landscape trees in a setting where you're maintaining all the time. So all our trees fell basically between 0 and 4. And alarmingly, most of them were 0, 1s, and 2s. And so, I mean, it showed the state of the forest is it's in pretty rough shape out there.
Thanks. And again, those assessments were done on the aggregation areas. That's the concentration we looked at, is what's happening to trees right around our aggregation areas. And I'll get to this in a second. This shows an infrared view of the site out there, which is one of the tools we use to assess the conditions. But the concentration on assessing trees was how are the aggregation sites doing, what's the prognosis for their future, and what do we have to worry about this year as far as continued damage out there. So those assessments were concentrating on the butterfly areas. And in some of those cases, you know, a third of the trees that are directly related to the butterfly areas are dead. And that has a significant effect on the ability of that location to harbor butterflies and to persist as an important aggregation site. So this is a infrared shot of the grove. This was taken at the end of June. And what this is showing is the really bright light areas, like I'm pointing at over here. If you can, that doesn't show up too well. How about this one? right in here, that's the golf course. And so you see the fairways and the greens, that's a really well-watered area. Now, what infrared is doing is it's showing water content in the vegetation. And so these pinker areas like this, down along here, right along Devereux Creek, there's a bunch of ash trees down there. Those have a really bright and high transpiration rate, so it's showing a lot of moisture. And as you can see in the eucalyptus grove, there's a variation in colors through here. And what this is showing us is areas where there's very little moisture. This is Elwood North, and this is a large patch of dead trees in Elwood North. And there's other areas down here. This is what we call the sandpiper aggregation site. And in that location, those trees were healthier. Now, the difference in the rating system is I think the average of trees down here was around 2.5 in that rating system. The average up in Elwood and in Elwood, Maine, was right around 1.5, 1.6. So it gives you a little bit of idea of the average. That means there's a lot of dead trees in those areas. Other areas in the grove where there's significant die-offs, this is Elwood, Maine, right here. And just to the west, this section of the grove has a large number of trees that are dead. And to the east side, right in here, there's a very large patch, which is, if you've walked through there, it's just it's a disaster right now. It's just a huge area of dead trees and fallen trees and broken and dying trees. Other areas in the grove are not as bad. Some of these guys are down right in Devereux Creek. They had good moisture, and so they're still doing okay. And we'll probably get back to this for some further discussion. We also ran a model on it, and this is a normalized difference vegetation index. So what this does is basically assess the amount of chlorophyll that's in the image that you're looking at, and it provides an index as far as what's going on with the health of the grove. So these dark areas and red areas are areas where there's either bare ground or dead vegetation. Some of it is looking through the trees. Remember, this is all just looking from the top down. So some of this is looking through trees and picking up the dead grass on the ground. And that's some of you see these large areas like this in Elwood North, that there's just a lot of dead wood up there, and you're looking through it. Other areas down the south that some of you may have noticed and coming out of the trail at the bottom, is this is another large area of dead trees down in this site. And then over here by Elwood, Maine, which is right here, there's another large patch of dead trees down in this area as well. So this gives us some way to estimate condition of the grove overall, and kind of find out where we're going and general condition of the trees. There is some regrowth and good canopies that are occurring, like here in Sandpiper. Again, that location had a lot of water because of the golf course next door and also right on the drainage. So there are areas where there's good growth. And along in here, some of these canopies are still staying green in this area and in the middle of Elwood North too. So that's just is a tool that we use to just assess the grove condition in general. We also did an actual survey of individual trees, and Corey did this to just determine how many dead trees are in Elwood. This is a partial list of the dead trees. What this covered, and I'm going to go back one slide. So I say grove number one, the number of dead trees there. That area is the southern swath of forest. So basically this whole area from here across here, that was assessed. And in that area, there is 343 dead trees. And those are dead. They're not recoverable trees. They're dead. And then in the other area, grove number two, there's 168. And that area is this northern, just from about here north, that section. So we still haven't tallied all the dead trees in here or other areas in the grove. So this is a preliminary number as far as the totals of dead trees in the area. We estimate in other areas, I think this is a very low estimate of 100. And then there's, in our assessment, there's probably about 200 or so trees that need safety trimming along trails, places where there's dead branches hanging off that are safety risks to other trees and to public safety. And let me just say that, you know, my approach on this was, what can we do to protect the aggregation sites? And that was, you know, my first and primary focus. And a lot of these safety issues and tree issues have to do with what's going to happen if we leave these large trees in place and just let them fall. And in a lot of cases, and particularly in Elwood, Maine, those trees are integrated with other trees that are still alive. A number of these that have this epicormic regrowth back that still provide habitat value for the butterflies. And if these trees, which can break and fall without notice, and we can't predict when they're going to fall, they're going to take down other living trees. So we're in a place with Elwood, Maine in particular, where a large storm could come through and knock down a number of these dead trees, which are ready to fall, and we're going to lose a lot more living trees. So that's one of the issues that I'm addressing and looking at very carefully with regard to what should be done out there, because we're in a situation where we could lose a lot more of the grove if we do nothing. And, of course, this whole thing adds up to 833. Now, there's no plan that I'm working on right now that's talking about taking out 833 trees, but we're being very selective in going through and seeing what trees are going to be able to be left and what is going to put a risk of public safety and habitat if they're left in place. So that's the approach that I'm looking at it, and we can discuss that in detail. The pests that have been working out there, and a lot of the dilemmas with trees that are stressed is then these pests get great opportunities to damage the trees. And the one that does the most damage and actually kills the tree is the longhorn borers. They get in and girdle the tree, and that just kills the tree. And there's, of course, a lot of evidence out there. If you look at any of the logs, you can see all the galleries that are along in these older logs. They've been present for a long time out there, and they used to be fairly well kept under control just by biological means, parasitoid wasps primarily. But they're under the bark. They're extremely difficult to kill. And the best method for doing that is systemic pesticides, but we have a butterfly grove. You put systemic pesticides on eucalyptus so they drink the nectar, and you have no more butterflies. So pest control has to be by natural means, and unfortunately, when we have a drought like this, the result is that these beetles explode in numbers, and they kill a lot of trees. The other pest we have out there is a tortoise beetle, and there's a number of other ones, too. There's actually a eucalyptus weevil now that's active, and the psyllid, psyllids you see all over the leaves, they're active as well, and they've stressed the trees additionally. I have never seen an outbreak of tortoise beetles anywhere like we see in the eucalyptus forest right now. Usually the adults, which is this guy. Oh, that's the wrong one. This guy right here is the adult. And usually you don't see those out during the day. Their behavior is typically to hide under bark or leaves during the day. You can see them all over the place. The numbers are so huge that they're present everywhere. And you see this kind of damage on the leaves. The leaves are all chewed up. That's the tortoise beetle. So that just places additional stress on the trees. And all these things have combined to lead to this problem in this condition. So how did this all affect the butterflies? Well, butterfly numbers in general are quite a bit lower than they were. This is the numbers from 1999 and just shows you the size of the circles is the size of the number of butterflies that were in all these different aggregations across the county. This is based on about 103 sites that are located in the county of monarch butterfly aggregation sites. And the biggest number there was a max of 2,100 butterflies in November 1999. So what's the number last year in the county? And that was the maximum size of an aggregation in the county in 2016. This is from the studies that we did and also the Xerxes Society data that contributed to these numbers. So you can see that's a pretty dramatic drop in the overall number of butterflies at the site. And that affects what shows up at Elwood as well. So our butterfly areas, again, to go through this, Elwood North, which is up here, Elwood North, the Sandpiper butterfly site. We have a location here, Elwood West, along Devereux Creek, and then the Elwood Main site right here. And then there's another site over here, Elwood East. There's also a little site here, Ocean Meadows, which very rarely has butterflies in it, and that's not included in our analysis yet. But that's a very rare site to have any butterflies in it. I think the last time I saw 10 butterflies there was probably maybe 5 years ago. Not quite sure on that time. So in the Elwood butterfly counts, as far as the overall population that shows up here, these are the numbers from 1997 onward. And you can see we had some really great peak years, close to 58,000, I think, was the highest one here. These are all November counts. In some cases, the numbers were actually higher in January. But this is the last year, 2016, and that was the lowest count we ever had. It was some 2,300 or so. It was 1,300 on this count, I believe. And the next lowest one was about 2,300, 1,000 over. So this was a really low count for elwood, the lowest that we've seen, and the lowest I've seen in 28 years of looking out there. So the number of butterflies overall was greatly affected. This also translates over into the specific butterfly sites, as the behaviors were much different. These years where we've seen 50,000 butterflies in Elwood, Maine, this year the peak was about 2,300. And in January in particular, there were 123 butterflies counted in Elwood, Maine in the first week of January. That's typically, from my experience, the peak number of butterflies that occur there. So 40,000, 20,000, 50,000 is what you'd expect to see there. This year we had 123. And the 1st of February, there were zero butterflies in aggregation in Elwood, Maine. At the same time, Sandpiper, the numbers were much higher. That's a site with much better tree conditions. So Sandpiper held the most butterflies. Elwood, Maine had a very, very low number of butterflies, and I think that's directly related to the condition of the grove. So I'm going to turn this over for some comments as to what's going on now.
Thank you. And that's...
Oh, yeah. All right, so you've kind of got the science on the bad news that we're facing in our Elwood Mesa, and we have taken some actions to date to address public safety. Because public safety, of course, is a primary consideration, and that notably the trails through the eucalyptus canopy and making sure that those trails are closed down. So that action's already been taken. We have closed the trails. We have installed trail closure signage. We've done a press release. We have a website about the trail closures and public safety issues. And if you have questions later during question and answer, our community outreach manager, Valerie Kushnerov, is here, and she can give you more information about where you can get information. And then we've also coordinated with the Coastal Commission and Fish and Wildlife. And we have some representatives from those agencies in the audience tonight. And we also have an upcoming meeting with the Coastal Commission to go out and take a look at the site and discuss what we've done and what we can do in the future together. So I wanted to be sure that you know what we have done to site and to date and what we haven't done. We haven't taken any trees out, and we haven't altered the forests at all, nor have we developed a definitive plan of action for the future. We just know that there's public safety issues, that we have a number of dead and diseased trees that pose a public safety risk, and they also pose a habitat risk to the habitat that's within Elwood Mesa. So it's not just the people that are unsafe, but it's also the habitat itself. So we had some maps printed at the foyer when you walk in. If you want a copy, they're also online. But here's our map of trail closures on Elwood. You can still get to the beach. You can still enjoy Elwood Mesa proper on the grassland areas. So by all means, continue to visit Elwood Mesa. Just stay safe and avoid the eucalyptus canopies. You'll see a lot of signs, so that should make it really clear where not to go, so that you can see where you should go. I just looked over at our Neighborhood Services Public Safety Director at Vito Adamidis, and he reminded me that just by looking at him, that we have a lot of people going into the eucalyptus canopy, and it's really unsafe. I'm not just making that up. We have arborists, but we also have safety experts that have gone in and said it's not safe. We do have some homeless encampments. We have campfires out that we do patrols to stop. And so we just want to alert you that it's really unsafe to be in the canopy, and it's really unsafe and unwise to have campfires. So if you see any campfires, tell them to put it out and call the authorities so that we can make sure that that is addressed immediately. So the next step for addressing the public safety issue is we have a very short window. And the reason that we have a short window of time to act is because we have tree nesting windows where we cannot do work when birds are nesting. Not tree nesting, bird nesting. That was good. But no one laughed, though, so I think I might have, like, snuck that one on you. And then in addition, we also have the butterfly window, which starts up this fall. So we can't disturb the area for the birds and the butterflies, which gives us about September to do work in the grove if we were to do work. So the first thing we do is coordinate with the agencies. And because they're obviously, they have regulations and jurisdiction on Elwood Mesa. We are working on a tree management action plan. So this happened pretty quickly. We responded pretty quickly. So I think there's some public has been aware of the fact that we're looking at the tree trimming, tree removal, but it's because we're developing an action plan with options so that we can come back to the city council and to the public to lay out what these options might look like, how much they might cost, what issues relate, you know, what are the pros and the cons. So that's what we're doing, and that's what the flurry of activity is and why we have a lot of consultants on board, why eventually, hopefully soon, we'll release a bid to tree trimming companies to come in and give us advice, give us some ideas and costs for various ways that they might recommend addressing the public safety issue. And then Althaus and Mead will be helping us with the habitat values issue to make sure that any tree trimming or tree removal proposal will also benefit or maximize any kind of benefits that there might be for the butterflies. And then the next step would be to retain a contractor and implement the plan. Notice there's no timeline specific to that because we don't know exactly how this is going to roll out. We're just taking it one step at a time. But we know that we have to develop an action plan and map every single tree out there that needs attention. And we're not forgetting about what happens next. As a matter of fact, that is what we were doing. We were looking originally for the last few years, been looking at a long-term management plan for Elwood Mesa, how to, under the guidance of our general plan, how to manage the butterfly habitat. And that has been pretty tricky because we have a lot of conflicting demands in the grove, fire, birds, butterflies, public safety, and regulations. And so it's been quite challenging to put all of these pieces together. But the urgency now to move forward with the restoration plan is upon us. That plan is something that we're going to work with you and the agencies on. And hopefully we can, pull the community together to address all of the varying interests so that we can really see the long-term vision for Elwood Mesa with that something sustainable and not something that we're going to have to continually go back and address these types of issues, particularly in droughts and temperature increases, and we have aging trees. So we'd like to be able to put all of that together and work through a long-term restoration plan. We were going to work through the issues through our Parks and Recreation Commission. They are the experts on providing us with advice on what we do in our parks and how we manage our parks. So we just wanted to make sure that you knew that we will be doing public outreach separately, but our Parks and Rec Commission will be our one of our main audiences. And so this, I'm going to let Dan talk about this slide, as I think it's just, he makes a good point when he talks about all of the varying interests when it relates to habitat management.
Thank you. Well, this is a complicated slide because this is a complicated problem. And there's a lot of interests and a lot of concerns that go into the solutions for the problem. And the thing I want to emphasize is the goal is to have a solution that produces a sustainable butterfly aggregation site in this location and allows public access and doesn't get branches of trees dropped on people. So there's kind of three facets here. The one thing is we have a declining grove, and the factors that are involved in that are droughts and pests, damage to the trees, and fallen trees. And, of course, fire is a real concern out there when you have that much fuel load on the ground. And eucalyptus groves in general are just dangerous with respect to fire. We have a lot of public interest, as we can see, in this situation, and that goes everything from public safety to recreation to education. There's a lot of educational programs that go on out in this grove that visit the monarch site. And this is also economically a very important location for the city of Goleta, and certainly for all your residents as far as the use of this site. And then we have biological solutions. And I want to emphasize that there are solutions to these problems. There's things we can do. We can work with the forest. We can enhance generation out there. We can replant trees. We can consider other activities that may involve different species of trees on the site. This is the time to think about and talk about all of that. And so there are solutions that can bring back and recover restoration areas. And, you know, this has been done in other places. There's a good example up the coast that we have of a successful restoration of a site that was destroyed for activities up there. And there's a lot of work that's going on in this, both here and in San Luis Obispo County and other areas that are looking at restoration activities and the structures of groves, what makes a successful monarch butterfly aggregation site. So I fully expect to see butterflies back at Elwood, Maine, some back this year. We'll see what kind of effect that has. It depends a lot on the weather and our increased growth and how the epicormic growth does and the recovery of those trees. Structurally, we may be in a different place for many years out there as far as the upper canopy structure, but I still expect to see butterflies back there. There will be butterflies in the eucalyptus complex, whether they're at Elwood, Maine or not. And there are solutions that can be had to these problems, so we have to apply our knowledge to that and come up with good solutions. But again, it is a lot of issues and a lot of items to consider and to integrate into how we approach the problem.
Okay, I think we've talked enough. I'm going to leave this slide up that talks about where you can get more information on what we're doing and where we're headed, and we'll continually update that website. So I'm going to leave that up on the screen, and then we have our microphones roving. I know there's people with questions, so I think the best approach here might be just to raise your hand and ask your question and make sure that you're saying it into the microphone. And then if you want to direct your question at a particular person, you have a lot of, or issue area, if it's public outreach, just say it's public outreach and we'll get Valerie over here. Or if it's parks and recreation, we can bring in Joanne. Public safety, we can pull in Vito. So you just, if it's science, you know, we got our science team here. So this is time to ask your questions, so please ask away. We've got some questions over here, or hands over here, probably with questions. Oh, there we go. Test.
Well, I didn't even
test. Test.
Hey, I was waving at somebody.
Is this on?
All right. Sorry. Hi, Chris Lang. I have so many questions, but not, and they're not all phrased like questions. I have data, and I wonder if you have. And you know, it's like there's so much to talk about, and I don't want to hog it, but there's more than we can do tonight. First things I want to say is, with all the action plan discussion, I saw somewhere in the literature, maybe the PowerPoint lit, it says something like there will be a restoration plan. That should be X'd out, and you should not start one single thing without a restoration plan in place. And that's because we have a lot of things that can live out there with the dead trees still there. That means we have to do a kind of a dance around this public safety thing. We need to think about phasing this, because you need to, this is an experimental situation. You need to take a section that needs help and work, find out what sections, work on them, and stop, and then wait until you see if it was a good result or not. You don't take 800 trees out by October 1st. Forget it. The monarchs picked in this county 103 sites. How many of them were anything but eucalyptus? I don't want to hear about changing to native trees right now, because the monarchs told us what they want. They chose eucalyptus. Sad as it is, yes, they fall down. Yes, they're a problem for some of us in other ways, but that's monarch habitat here in this county. All right. I do have a couple questions. Who's going to be on this science team? We have people like Kingston Leong and other people up in San Luis Obispo who have been working in their areas. I would love to hear that you're going to be collaborating with them. I know Rincon is involved, Karis and other people. We need to have a good-sized team, and the public should be present. When you do anything out there, you need a biologic monitor every time you go out, because we've seen some things in this last year, since December of last year, that weren't very well done. And we would like to be sure that the public is told, and you have public liaisons who are present and able to be there appropriately with whatever they want, cameras, with whatever they need to observe what's going on, just like you have biologic monitors. Because what has happened up here up to this point leaves a lot of questions. You have closed the grove. You need to deal with a CDP from the Coastal Commission. I don't know if you even have one. So, I mean, there's a lot to be done. And I would like to make sure this is just the beginning of a public process that's very transparent, not just on a website, here, where people can talk about it.
Thank you, Chris. And yes to everything that you said. They're all things that we're talking about. We have hired an environmental consulting firm to do monitoring so that we can call them at a moment's notice to get their assistance. And we have started a science group. And so I think I'm going to let Dan talk about the team that he started.
Yeah, we have already had meetings with Kingston Leon and Francis Villablanca. They're part of the group. Emma Pelton up at the Xerxes has been invited and asked. I've been corresponding with her. And we want everybody who's interested to be involved, and particularly the scientists that are interested. And, of course, the service folks are involved in this, too. So we've reached out to quite a number of folks, and everybody that would like to participate, we welcome to be involved.
Dan, we had a question over here.
Thank you. Can you hear me? I have a bunch of questions, and like Chris, I'd like to see a stepwise phased approach to this, not just whack out a bunch of trees and here we go. And you and I talked in the woods the other day when I was on the path. I'd like to see what happens when we take some of the trees out. We talked about the possibility of erosion, what happens to the raptors as well as the butterflies. And we've seen eucalyptus recover. A direct question, do you expect the trees with epicormic growth to survive?
I expect most of those will.
Okay.
And you know, we have a couple of examples of a few that haven't, notably that one large tree right in the corner across from the school that had some sprouts, came back. It's now dead. So that, unfortunately, that's one of the things that can happen. We're not sure how many of those are going to make it through the hot summer.
And are there things that we can do to help those trees survive? And is that being talked about?
I think that's going to be a tough situation right there, trying to help them survive. They're on their own right now, just trying to survive, and that's what they're doing.
Okay.
I mean, without water, it's going to be tough.
Okay. Yesterday morning, two city trucks pulled up to the bottom of the Coronado Hill where the dirt path goes up, and they put the tape across and the signs down at the bottom of Coronado Hill. I went out and talked to them, and they were very nice, so I want to say thank you for that. So far, nobody's been defensive. I really appreciate that, and I'm hoping that we can all work together and come to a good process here. They said they were told by their supervisor to put the tape across the bottom of the path by the Coronado signs. And I said, there's not even any eucalyptus on the Coronado Hill. They called their supervisor. I don't know what the conversation was, but they removed that tape and they removed those signs. And I bring this up because I think it was an important interchange, and everybody was polite. And I think we got a better result, but it also points out that we can't just thoughtlessly do this. And I think it might be better for the butterflies if we close Elwood, Maine to the public while we get through this, but I'd like to see the first, if it's needed, tree removal happen along a couple of more paths out to the bluffs. Make it safe for people, because people are going to walk out there. You saw me. You know? And thank you for the process, and I agree again with Chris. I'd like to see, you know, like an orange tag on all the trees that you want to cut, and let's step this and take the really most dangerous ones first, see where we go from there, and work it like that, but let us see what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So that we're helpful.
Right, thank you very much. And just to be clear, you know, no one is proposing cutting 800 trees. What we're looking at is very specific trees that are imminent danger trees and trees in the aggregation sites that are likely to damage the site further. And you know, we're undergoing a very careful analysis of that. And all these trees, we have a process that, you know, if we do take any trees out, that's going to be a very careful process that will identify them all ahead of time by individual name and number. And there's a series of things we go through to make sure that there's no mistakes made. So we're working on those protocols right now. So it's going to be a very careful process, and there's a lot of evaluation that goes on with each of these proposed removals.
Hi, I'm Erin Grote. I live over by the Butterfly Preserve. And first of all, I'd like to take a moment to just thank everybody that was involved in spending your after-hours time this evening here. To me, it was pretty clear throughout the entire presentation how much work has gone into this and how much scientific analysis has taken place. And I just want to say how much I really appreciate that. I thought it was very clear during your presentation that you were trying to mitigate the damage. But I also heard the urgency loud and clear, especially because it seems like you guys are operating within a very slim time frame to protect the birds and to protect the monarchs. And I appreciate that. One question I did have for you is, I do believe in your presentation you mentioned that there was a project up the coast that had some successful results. Mm-hmm. And I'd just like to know if you could talk a little bit more about that project, the similarities, and what the results and time frame were.
Sure. It was a very different scale project. That was up at Cemeterio Canyon up by the Gaviota Refinery. And that was an area where one of the big pipe structures went through that location, cut down a lot of trees there. And then there was a fire in front of it. And that wasn't the fire, 7 years ago now or so, or 10 years ago, whenever that was. This was a different one. So there was a restoration area designed up by Adrian Winter up at that site. And this was quite some time ago, but that was planted with eucalyptus trees in his magic circle. And it actually was successful. It worked out pretty well. So the trees recovered, grew there, and butterflies utilized that site. So that's something that's possible. You know, we've worked over the years on a number of potential sites, but it's been a very, not been a very common thing to get done, and a very difficult thing to have people agree to that, okay, we're going to try and create a butterfly site. So it's a rare thing that's been attempted. As far as recovery of trees, so Kingston Leon did a really nice recovery project up in San Luis Obispo County in the Morro Bay area, where they planted a eucalyptus up there in a forest again. And that's been a very successful recovery, too. And again, that was using the appropriate conditions and shape to create a aggregation habitat up there. So he's had good success with that as well. He was here in a meeting here in this room a few weeks ago, and he specifically said, you know, to be encouraging about this. This is something that can be recovered. There are ways to do it, and he's seen how to do it, and so he's involved with our program.
My name is Ken Tedro. I want to also thank you guys for everything you've been doing. We know the things that... Is this on?
No.
Is it on? Yeah, okay. All right, and my question would be, we've talked about, Chris was concerned about the idea of changing out to a more indigenous trees. Trees are more native to this area here, and she's concerned about that. The monarchs obviously have chosen eucalyptus here. But as I understand it, in Monterrey, Mexico, they use pines. And so it's not necessarily one kind of tree that they will go for. They just want to have the shelter from the wind and also the cold and also, you know, sunlight, limitations and so on. So are there indigenous trees that we have that, if we're thinking about going that direction, that would really be something that the monarchs might be interested in and still be something that's really going to handle drought and the whole situation that we have in the climate environment we have here?
So I'll be the planner and give you the response to that question with kind of the bad news. When we have habitat that's environmentally sensitive habitat, we're in the coastal zone, there are certain restrictions on what we can and can't plant in our open space area, especially along our creek corridors. So regulations tend to favor natives. They don't favor the non-natives. However, in this case, we think that we have a good case for eucalyptus. As far as how far agencies will let us look at other species that are not native to this area, like pines or cypress, the jury's out on that, and I think it's going to challenge all of us from a regulatory standpoint as far as what can be allowed to be replanted from a regulatory perspective. But from the science perspective, I will let Dan talk about.
Good.
And you're certainly right about the Mexico aggregations. They're all in pines. We know a lot about aggregation locations and the conditions that butterflies prefer. A lot of that is by measure, and a lot of it is just by visiting a lot of sites and the experience of seeing them. And they like an area with an open space, kind of cathedral-like shape, is kind of the ideal butterfly habitat. Creating those spaces require tall trees, and they also require trees that can buffer wind and create an environment with a lot of biomass that ameliorates temperature and humidity extremes. That's why they're here, is so they get away from the coldest colds and the hottest hots during the winter, and they get in places that are protected from the wind. So there's a number of trees that can provide that function. We know that from studies that Jessica Griffiths, who's a colleague in our office, that she did up in Monterey County and actually in Santa Cruz County, that if they're given the choice, butterflies preferentially will cluster on conifers. And when there's a mix of eucalyptus and conifers in the same location. So that's one study that was done that demonstrated that. There's still other studies that need to be done to further examine that question. But we know that they do aggregate in those trees and cluster on conifers as well. So there is a question as far as if we're having areas, and I showed you some of those areas on the infrared, these large areas of dead forest. That's a question where there's a potential for a restoration in a small area like, it looks like a big area, but that's a portion of the grove that we could consider doing some work like that. And the idea was thrown out this is experimental. I think that's correct. We really haven't done it's certainly not an Elwood Mesa. Everything is different everywhere you go. So it's a bit of an experiment to see what happens, although with proper care and installation and management, you can have successful recruitment of trees. And that's something that can be done. We know how to do that. So there's a certain amount of assurance that we can cause trees to grow with the proper care. That's a matter of resources, but it can be done. So to kind of answer your general question, in light of what Ann just said, there's certainly, as far as the biology goes, there's real opportunities to provide a mix of species, to create a habitat that is protective and provides the conditions that butterflies need. We also know something about the penetration of light into the sites and the canopy cover that's ideal for their recruitment to those locations and for their overwintering habitats. There's levels of indirect and direct light that our colleague Stuart Weiss has worked on canopy hemispherical work on that and established some of those parameters. So there's things like that that we can shoot for, targets that we can aim to hit that are potential restoration parameters we can look at.
So we have indigenous trees. I mean, trees are, that are drought tolerant. That we have trees that are drought tolerant that we could put in there that would service the
yeah,
the
and we
tallness and all that whole canopy thing you're talking about.
Yeah, as far as attaining the high canopy, that's where eucalyptus are so great. Frankly, it's difficult to create something like that with pines in less than 50 years. you know. So that's a difficulty with that. But they can provide good wind buffer out on the edge of the grove and some of the interior areas of the grove within a few years, really. If you get some of the pines that we're looking at grow pretty fast. And that's potential to add some habitat value, particularly in the areas of the grove that have been really, really hurt by the drought. And, you know, the area on the bank above Devereux Creek to the west of Elwood, Maine, that's an area that provides a lot of wind protection for Elwood, Maine itself. There's a great number of dead trees up there. That's one of the areas I'm concerned about as far as the need for immediate restoration. And as far as native tree goes, there are a few areas here, actually in Goleta, where I've observed butterflies aggregating on oak trees, coast live oaks. Those are in association with eucalyptus in the same location, and they actually set up clusters on the coast live oaks, so that's a potential as well. The Monterey cypress is a tree that's put in restoration areas. Pismo Beach has used that in their grove. You may have heard they've had a big collapse up in Pismo Beach as well, where a large tree came down up there and opened up a whole side of that aggregation habitat. And they're looking at a restoration program up there right now that includes Monterey cypress and perhaps some pines in that location. So there's opportunities that way with native trees. Also, you know, even though sycamores are deciduous and willows are deciduous in Santa Barbara County, there are habitat locations, aggregation habitats, where those are the primary trees that butterflies actually aggregate on in the winter. So there's some potential there as well.
Two questions. Anne, will there be a website where we can monitor the progress of the planning and the assessment and then make input and kind of keep abreast of what you're dealing with and your progress?
So the website link that we have right now is posted up on the screen, and there's a card. Valerie, I see you over there. Did you want to add anything? Because this has been moving really fast.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to let... So we've actually been kind of dividing up issues and letting people run with them. Well, you got a card. That's good. Go ahead, Valerie.
Well, first of all, I just wanted to say thanks to everyone that showed up tonight. It's so evident how many people love Elwood Mesa and the butterfly groves and how important this issue is to our community. So like Anne said, we have this website set up for the project. We have information available in English and Spanish, and we would really encourage you to sign up for our updates. You can text Goleta Elwood to 468-311 or go on that link to sign up for email notifications. And for any of you that followed us during the fire, you got a number of updates from us and know that that is really a priority for us to educate the public on what's going on. So I would encourage you to sign up that way. That's the best way to get project information. And of course, you're always welcome to call me. I'm happy to help.
Then an observation and a question for the technicians. My name's Wes Herman. I'm a retired fire captain and arborist also. I had a tree business in Southern California. Let's see. The area along the eastern border of the parallels Pebble Beach there, there's the Edison lines that run along under those trees. I live at the end of Pismo Beach Drive, for instance, and about 35 to 50 feet behind my fence, the trees have attained a height of over 120 feet, which worries me a little bit. The reason that they're so healthy and they're the first tier is because they've got tap roots going into our yards and they get our domestic water. So my water bill goes high, even though I've taken real, real strong measures to do subterranean watering and stuff like that. Is there any thought for, as far as safety aspect goes, this, and I saw you had a safety aspect included in your plan, to maybe top some of those really tall trees that are subject to the northwest winds that get strong after the rain falls and softens the soil?
All right, you know it's not good when the scientists are looking at me for that one.
No, it's a team effort.
Yeah, it is a team effort. That's why we're all here. And this is a moving target. So that's part of the option. So thank you. That's another option. When we get more arborists input and more tree trimming experts input as far as what various solutions we have, that's probably going to be one of them. So thank you.
Yeah. And Dan mentioned the and other people mentioned the type of trees we're dealing with, the eucalyptus. They're famous in firefighter lore. They drop about 15 tons of burnable material a year, and that includes branches, acorns, leaves, and bark. They're one of the worst, and they go dry and they burn quick, and I've fought fires in them. And I'm worried about the limbs that are overhanging those Edison lines. So that's one of the considerations that brought that question up. And thank you for your efforts and bringing us all into your plan. I appreciate it.
Just a comment, since you brought up leaf litter. That is one of the issues with maintenance in eucalyptus groves. And one of the things that happens is if leaf litter is allowed to build up for long periods of time without disturbance, there's a lot of oil in eucalyptus leaves and bark, and that migrates to the top layer of the soil. And this is actually Matt Ritter up in Cal Poly has done some work on this. And that concentrates in the top layers of the soil. It creates a hydrophobic layer that sheds water. And that's one of the issues that we've had as far as water penetrating into the grove. If there's no disturbance in there in those areas, that layer can build up and actually reduces the ability of that ground to soak water in during our rain periods.
The former city manager, Dan Singer, and I discussed the possibility of bringing a chipper out to the end streets where there's access right to the forest, maybe once a month. And instead of putting our green waste in the green can, bring it there and chip it and spread it in the forest. That probably would violate EASHA regulations, but it might actually, because if you start to create an organic layer, it would decompose into good soil and feed those, because the soil there is very starved. It's low in nutrients.
Okay, so for the people who weren't able to hear Wes's comment, he was talking about chipping and chipping in place, but that's also something that we're talking about is the understory and chipping. But I do want to point out that really dead wood doesn't chip. It's just too dead. It'll eat up a chipper. Or at least that's what we've come to the conclusion of so far. But again, when we do talk to more, experts and see a lot of different bids coming in on different ways that we can address this, then we'll get more input from the public that have this in their expertise. Okay.
Scott Cooper, I had a question about dovetailing your short-term action plan with your long-term restoration plan. This goes back to Chris's point, but the basic issue is what you do in the short-term action plan will determine what you can do in the long-term restoration plan. And so if you only clear small areas and a goal is to bring back native vegetation, eucalyptus is notorious for excluding native plants. They condition the soil, they change conditions around them, so it's very difficult to reestablish native vegetation. So I was wondering how you are proposing to deal with dovetailing something you need to do right away. I totally agree you've got huge liability concerns here with the long-term restoration plan that also needs to be in place so that you can have a continuous whole. The second part of the question is, what is the role of the city's tree advisory committee in this whole process? Thank you.
So I don't think we can emphasize it enough that there are a lot of competing demands on Elwood Mesa, competing interests, native species, birders like native species. They attract a bigger diversity in bird life. We have the butterflies, and they don't always line up. So the management strategies are complicated, and that's why you see agency representatives here tonight, because there's a lot of regulations as well that relate to all of this restoration. But we are looking at what we do now and how that might affect or impede what we do in the long run. But there's just a lot of pieces to put together. And so it's just something that we're unfolding. It's unfolding over time, and we're going to have to be back with you to have more detailed dialogue about how we overlap short-term and long-term actions with other agencies in particular and other scientists. So yeah, you're right on. It's going to be tricky. Oh, Tree Advisory Committee. The Tree Advisory Committee, unless I'm corrected, they do street trees. So they don't do our open space trees. But that doesn't mean that we're not going to inform them, because obviously this is an important topic and we're talking about trees. So yeah, they'll be part of the process too.
Oh, Marcia. My name's Marcia Pepper, and I have a home on Coronado Drive. I was reading the Habitat Project summary on your website, and it talks about how it's not possible to provide supplemental watering to the eucalyptus groves at Elwood because it's considered a natural area, and and I don't understand this concept because the eucalyptus are not native. It seems to me we're in a gray zone. That is, it's not totally a natural area because it's a non-native species, but it's been pretty much left on its own for many, many years. To me, it seems like one of the simplest things we could do to help the grove is to provide supplemental watering during drought periods. And no matter what we do, it seems like this would be helpful in the long-term growth of regeneration and growth of the eucalyptus, which are what the monarchs prefer overall. So if we're interested in maintaining the monarch habitat value of this site, it seems to me that's one of the easiest, simplest things that we should be able to implement. And I'm just hoping you could help me understand why that hasn't been considered a possibility yet.
So we have had that discussion about irrigation. And by the way, I remember when you used to run that hose across Coronado and as part of the restoration plan for the Coronado Butterfly Preserve. So in order to be able to artificially get involved with the habitat, we would need permits and water, and we would need to look at our general plan to make sure that we're not going sideways with our general plan, because we're intervening in what is otherwise natural habitat or treated as natural habitat or naturalized habitat. But we are looking at, we have had discussions about some options for long-term practices to include some type of irrigation. So that is something that's on the table. We just can't go out and just do it right now. We don't have the permit authority to be able to go out and start watering trees, nor do we have the water connections. So that would be a project in and of itself.
Just a question kind of on the optics. When we first were starting to work on this 20 years ago, and then through work with FOTEC and TPL, we brought a lot of people in on this in terms of having to understand what was going on before there was a city. And my question is, I appreciate the outreach. What kind of outreach is going to be, what's the messaging going to be, and what's the outreach going to be beyond Goleta? We have a lot of people that come up, you know, buses and buses park in front of our house on Coronado. Now they park up in the other lot, but not always. What's going to be your communication plan for folks that are going to show up here in November and December, as they do every year from Monterey Park and all the communities down south? I mean, how are you going to deal with the fact that you're going to do a local closure? I mean, we're not going to 911 reverse those guys. So
we are working on that issue, and I'll let Valerie talk about that.
So thanks for the question. We've already been posting information on our GoletaButterflyGrove.com website, which is how tourists generally get information. And we'll be scouring Google to find out the tour companies that are operating tours that come up and visit the Butterfly Grove. Unfortunately, there's not a registry for companies that come up and do that. So it's haphazard in our ability to find those people, but we're already working on seeking them out now, because we don't want people to come up and then go into the grove, even though it's blocked off, and be in unsafe conditions and missing out. We certainly want people to have the experience in the future of visiting the grove, but this may not be the year for them to do that. So we'll be updating our Yelp listing and using some other social media tools to try to reach those people.
Sunset was a big impact, Sunset Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Are you guys considered actually making this something we can be proud of?
That's a great idea. We'll be in touch with Sunset Magazine as well. We're working with Go Goleta, which is the local tourism bureau that works to bring visitors here, and we've already asked them to take down all of their information about visiting the Grove. Bacara has also done some butterfly tours, and we're working with them as well. Thank you. So we do have an online registration form for field trips usually that's on GoletaButterflyGrove.com. There's already information saying that we don't know yet if we'll be able to offer field trips this year. We'll be contacting all of the previous field trip groups and letting them know that this may not be the year that they'll be able to come out to the grove. So because I don't know the answer to that question yet, we're trying to work this in stages. And as school gets back in session, we'll be definitely working with the school groups. Thank you.
Hi, Michael Grote. I live right by the preserve as well, and I want to echo everybody's appreciation for what you're doing. I have a pretty simple question. As you remove trees and are replacing them, do you plan on putting saplings in or already partially mature to provide the wind block and the sunlight? Or lack thereof?
We don't know. But we will know eventually.
Chris Hall, and I live in the Eucalyptus Grove condos, and this isn't my point, but it's important to note that we've been fighting the Lerps psyllid for more than 10 years now, and they don't seem to want to go away. It just doesn't get better. It just keeps them from dying as long as you keep treating it every year. But my question is kind of something very simple. I'm a little bit confused about dead trees that can regenerate. What would be the effect of simply culling out the dead trees? If we weren't able to plant anything new, would we have huge areas of devastation, or would things begin to grow slowly if we were to just cull out dead material?
So that's kind of the heart of the issue is, what do we do with the dead trees? Because eventually they'll fall down. So they'll be down anyway. And so what are we going to do with it and when, and then what do we do afterwards? So we're struggling with that. And that's why there's so many of us in this room, and to the degree that we can work together to figure out how, we can address the issue, the sooner we can get to a solution. Yeah.
Yeah. With regard to clearing and tree, the eucalyptus grove will regenerate. There are seeds out there, but it also requires the proper kind of conditions to do so. So if we have a couple of years of hard drought, we're not going to have much in the way of saplings recruit to those areas. But clearing some of those areas, would probably help get seedlings established as long as the ground isn't cleared bare. Pardon?
We don't have to replant.
Well, we don't have to do much of anything, really. But what's going to be best for the grove? Is the question. And certainly the quickest way to recover some of these areas would be to clear the trees and replant. That'd be the fastest way to get trees back growing and cover back in the location.
Yeah. In spite of the drought, there's saplings on the edge of the tree that the forest is regenerating in some places already, up near the monument.
Right.
There's a lot of saplings that are really helping us.
Right. The comment was around the edge of the forest, there's a lot of little saplings regenerating. That's true. You go to the south of Elwood, Maine, and there's a lot of saplings in there along that edge, which is great. So, those are going to continue to grow in there, and that can happen. Yeah.
Hi, I was just reading about a similar situation up in Berkeley, and I don't want to jump the gun because I'm sure a lot of things will become clear as we go through this process. But one of the concerns that came from the public was once a dead eucalyptus is cut down and you've got this mound, just a dead mound, they were also spraying pesticides on it, like Roundup. So you had mentioned pests and things like that, and that rang an alarm bell for me because I don't really know what the plan is here, but certainly Roundup is not a friendly thing to have up in the grove.
No.
I'm not assuming that's what's going to happen because... something I read.
Well, thanks for that question. And there's no, I can't foresee any time when we would spray Roundup on a stump, because the idea is we want those trees to grow. And one of the methods, if you have a tree that's just about destroyed but still has some life in the bottom, you can cut it off at the ground and encourage those shoots to regrow. And Corey can explain that. You have a chance of really getting some nice trees that already have this huge root system and it can recover very fast. So one of the ideas on some of these trees that are basically have complete dead tops, but still some epicormic growth on the bottom, if you do take those off, that stuff can grow back really fast and recover very quickly. And then you selectively pick the shoots that you're going to retain And Corey, according to his explanation too, you can get some good trees out of that.
Yeah, I've seen it common practice in other groves and windbreaks where they've cut down blue gum eucalyptus trees and the resprouts, and they've come up and made pretty good substantial trees and grown at a pretty rapid rate. So I think it would be helpful to do that in some of the circumstances out there, depending on the health of the tree, how much epicormic growth it has, how tall it is. It would be a good way to solve some of the problem.
Sorry, hi, I'm Val. I work at UCSB. Actually, we have a scenario up the coast in San Francisco where almost parallels the challenges that we have here, but on a much grander scale. They're talking about thousands of trees as opposed to hundreds of trees. And this month, they released the environmental impact study, which is fascinating, and it'll take some time to get through. But I would really encourage that we all explore. They've worked very closely with UCSF. All these issues regarding removal of trees, regarding habitats, the butterflies, they've addressed every single one of these challenges for this particular preserve, grove, whatever you want to call it. And I think we could learn a lot from research they've already done and apply it to our grove. On a positive note, they believe they can restore the eucalyptus canopy. They're very specific in this report as far as what they would plant, where they would plant it, how much they would remove. It's being done in a phased plan, 1 to 5 years, 6 to 10 years, and ongoing. And I'm sorry, I don't think it's working. I'm sorry. I've just got the executive summary with me today, but even the issue that was brought up in water, that let me use my glasses or I won't be able to read it. The plan currently does not include an irrigation for the initial years of forest treatment. The goal is to establish new trees by planting just prior to the wet season so that irrigation is not needed. And if the planting and restoration efforts were unsuccessful, plants may receive supplemental water using backpack sprayers. So they have it's a very lengthy report, but they've addressed all these challenges. I think they're probably at least a year, 2 years ahead of us in this process. So it would just be a great resource. It's called the Mount Sutro Open Space Reserve. And like I said, the environmental impact study came out this month, and they're already. And just one last thing, when you had that graphed up for the water, for the butterfly numbers that went up, almost identically correlates with our annual rainfall. And so since we've had more than average rainfall this year, I'm really optimistic that that's going to bring the numbers up this coming year. Mm-hmm. So anyways, hopefully that's helpful.
Good. Thank you very much. Yeah, the USF Forest and Sutro Forest has been quite a long process and really controversial up there, and a lot of different ideas back and forth. And to have solutions is really, really encouraging. So that's certainly something we're going to be looking at, and I appreciate you bringing it up. Very important. And also, hopefully, the butterfly numbers will recover. There is some correlation with rainfall. I certainly saw it in 2010-2011 in the county. And we'll be hopeful that that'll follow the increase in milkweed and other plants that have happened in the area. As far as the same methodologies that they use in the San Francisco Bay Area, we're going to be a bit different here as far as the amount of water that the trees will need and the irrigation processes that go on here, because we have certainly...
How open are you guys to an environmental impact study locally? Is it specific for our...
We're not getting ready to cut down trees. We're trying to get options on the table so we understand what we're looking at, which would be the project description. And then you don't do environmental analysis till you have a project description. So it's one of those things where you have to do this part first in order to be able to assess what kind of environmental document that we need.
Would it help if we had water trucks out there watering now, if we could get emergency permit because this whole plan sounds like it's contingent upon getting rain in the future. If it's a native area and we can't mess with it by watering it or whatever, it seems to me that planting non-native species that have died out there is sort of messing with it. And if you plant new trees and you're not going to water them, it sounds like an invitation for disaster. So I guess my question for staff is, have we pursued the opportunity of bringing water in there? My question for the scientists are, if we had water trucks going along the top of the groves right now spraying water out, would it help the trees as far as those that are marginalized recover? Thank you.
So we have looked at irrigation options. We haven't moved forward with anything because we just haven't had time to act while we're developing some type of plan other than shutting down the trails for safety purposes. I will let Dan talk a little bit more about irrigation. I don't need to talk about the water and the value of water in our community and the resource that it is and the need to conserve. And so we're not saying that we've concluded that we're not going to look at water for the site, but we are proceeding with caution when we talk about emergency permits and watering. And there are also some tree issues related to watering, but I will let Dan talk about that.
Thanks. As far as watering now, we did get 25 inches of rain this year, so we're seeing a recovery of a lot of the trees and a lot of the epicormic growth that's occurring on trees. So I don't know if there's a great advantage to watering this year. If we have an extremely dry fall, there may be. And it also depends on kind of and the insect load too in the trees and how they're doing with respect to that. We certainly know that in California, if you plant a tree, you've got to water it. And that's just pretty typical. We've done a lot of restoration projects, and irrigation or some kind of supplemental water is always part of those here in this area. So I don't have any illusions that we would go out and plant a bunch of trees and just depend on rainfall here to take care of them all. We really have to have a plan in place that includes irrigation for replacement trees. Yeah. Yeah, as far as the trees that we're considering now, the zeros and the ones, the zeros out there, this 800 number that we've talked about, those trees are dead. So nothing's going to help those. They're gone. As far as the ones go, those are trees that, and Corey can address this a little bit better, I think, but those are trees that are severely stressed and may die. And a lot of those are already dead for a large part of the tree. For instance, the tops are dead. There's epicormic growth on the lower trunk, perhaps. It's that kind of a situation. And in those cases, I don't think supplemental water is going to do too much improvement on that at this point. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to mention that a lot of the ones are hazard trees. They're hung up over the pathways, or yesterday I was walking up there, and there was one tree right in the middle of the pathway, and it was rotten 6 to 7 feet up, right in the center. And I mean, it's going to have a failure, and it's right growing right in the middle of the pathway. So some of the ones possibly could be saved, and maybe some of those would be cut off and let to be stump sprouted. But it's just a case-by-case, tree-by-tree thing.
Yeah. I would just say something else about the ones is in the groves themselves, in the irrigation sites, I've looked at all of those trees that were rated ones, and a number of those I want to keep for this year just because they provide some cover for butterflies. There's epicormic growth on some of them, but it's still live cover that will produce some habitat benefit for the year, and those would be assessed and watched. We just keep track of them to see if any of those die or how many die or if they can recover. But most, just about all the ones that we've looked at, I'm planning on keeping.
Thank you for all the work you've done. You did a tremendous amount of analysis, and you identified four factors that seem to be contributing to the state the trees are in. But I was wondering if you had done any analysis on the increased foot traffic that we've had over the last 5 to 7 years, you know, starting with the Sunset Magazine and everything, we've had a tremendous amount increase of just people going through the grove. And I can't help but notice that not only are the areas that have increased butterflies are not visited very much by the public because they don't really know it's there, fortunately. Let's not let them know it's there. So I was wondering if that was part of your impact analysis. And a second question, not totally related, but for those trees that are maybe a zero or a one, are you prioritizing if those trees also maybe have like a raptor's nest or are some other biological importance before you consider cutting those down?
Answer to the second question first is absolutely. You know, raptor nests are things that we would protect. And so there are no, we've actually looked at all that. Each tree that was assessed, that was part of the assessment, was to say whether there was a raptor nest in the tree. So we have the data on all of that for each tree that we've assessed. And certainly, you know, there's restrictions on even work you can do. If you're within 500 feet of a raptor nest that's active, you can't disturb those raptors. So there's a lot of restrictions like that. Before any work would be done within the nesting bird season, which is, you know, not much longer relative to the amount of work that might be occurring. There has to be surveys ahead of time that determine if there's birds present and if they'd be disturbed by the work and put appropriate setbacks there. So that's all in place. And the first part of the question was?
The increased foot traffic?
Yeah, foot traffic. You know, my looking at these different sites and looking at what the difference is it really relates to their ability to be close to water. That's the difference that I'm seeing as far as the primary driver of why the trees are in better condition. For instance, sandpiper, right next to the golf course, right in the bottom of Devereaux Creek, it just gets a lot more water, and that's why the trees are in better condition there, in my opinion. It doesn't get foot traffic. There certainly is a compaction issue with water absorption into soil. So, you know, there might be a slight factor that's involved in there, maybe a percentage that's involved. But Elwood, Maine is also one of the sites that drains water through it during storms. So, you know, there's an ability of water to get there. And we haven't done an analysis on the impact of foot traffic per se there, but it certainly is much higher than other locations. The other locations, too, the Elwood West and East locations are right in the bottom of Devereaux Creek, and that explains a good bit about why the trees are in better shape there as well. You know. And along that line, too, just looking at Elwood North, that's in desperate condition, and there's very little foot traffic in that area of the grove. Well, it is. There's a trail that goes through there, but relative to the size of the grove, there's not much foot traffic in there. No, I'm talking about the northern part of the grove where most of the dead trees are. There's a one trail that wraps around by the main road up there and then comes back through. Yeah.
There's another trail.
So up in here, there's one that comes around here and it goes right through here. And then there's the cross trail here, which is the old road that used to go through there. This is the main trail that goes right through the center of the grove. And that one is not the one I'm talking about. A lot of the you know, real bad die-off is up in here. And that's just, I think, a function of soils and the amount of water that stays on that location. But and also exposure up there, I think. But, you know, you bring up a point that's important to consider. And I know in our management plan, that was one of the factors that was being considered in there. And certainly is worth taking a look at.
Yeah, I'm concerned about the actual process for removing the dead or whatever trees, you know, you decide need to be removed. Like what kind of equipment will be used and how do we avoid collateral damage to other parts of the habitat? And I have an example. In December, the city hired some contractors to remove one dead tree on the southeast end of Elwood, Maine. Before they did that, there were 2,000 butterflies in there. But anyway, in order to take that out and get the bobcat in there and everything, there were about a half a dozen smaller trees that were taken out. And the whole area of understory and litter was completely denuded up there, changing the microclimate in the whole Elwood, Maine. Now, it wasn't all that successful before that happened, but after that happened, as you pointed out, there were zero in there because the winds were coming in from the southern end of the grove. Anyway, so that was just from removing one dead tree. And there was a great deal of of live vegetation destroyed. How can we just take out, you know, when you talk about it, it sounds like a surgical thing, or the hand of God comes down and takes one tree out. But you got to get, don't you have to get like heavy equipment into the grove and maybe destroy viable parts of the habitat? That's a concern.
Well, that certainly is a big concern. And this goes to basically the action plan we're developing and the methodologies that we're looking at. A lot of it has to do with talking to tree companies and how this can be done. So their expertise must be involved in that. We have a pretty, we're starting to develop the protocols for how each tree would be removed and the measures that would be employed to protect that, those concerns. You know, there's some big trees in Elwood, Maine, and some of those dead trees are 100 feet tall. And I don't know if you can climb those trees and take them down piece by piece. That's the recommendation, is that they're taken down and lowered to the ground piece by piece. Handwork as much as possible. You know, I don't anticipate that there's, in many of those locations, you can get something like a cherry picker in there. So a lot of that will have to be hand. I'm not sure what can be used as far as cranes for reaching over and taking the hand of God, picking things out. Maybe that's a possibility. But those are all really important concerns. And the reason to take dead trees out of Elwood, Maine is twofold. One is to protect the rest of the trees there from getting crushed by one of those trees falling. And then the other reason is to open up some space again for other trees to recruit in. Of course, there's public safety, but you know that's an important issue as well, of course. But the method of taking those trees down is really important. And you know, we also are developing a protocol to make sure the correct trees are taken down and no other trees are taken down. That's going to be a sign-off form, in my opinion, which should happen for that, which requires a lot of folks to verify that that's the correct tree at the time of activity. And it will be a sign form, and my suggestion on that anyway. So this is really a concern of mine. And the thing, you know, some of those trees you look at, and it's like if you had to fall one of those trees, you take down three others with it. So that really is an important thing to define methodologies on that and make sure that we understand what's going to happen. I just, you know, this is such an important habitat that, you know, this the methodologies of doing this have to be really stringent. And that's certainly my goal in doing this and deciding whether a tree can come out or not.
All right. I'm Steve George. And this is a little broader question because Goleta has so few parks. We also have Los Coneros that has a series of dying and dead trees. We have the Redwood Grove that's almost completely dead. So when we're looking at this and we're learning as we're going along, are we going to be able to quickly apply it to our other park areas that are a mess?
You bring up a really good point about the canopy in general. I think I've heard Dan talk about 1.3 million dead trees in the state of California. 103 million. 103 million dead trees in the state of California. And we have a lot of dead trees in Goleta, too, not that many. But the city manager has instructed us to go and look at the canopy at Lake Los Carneros, for example, and other public open spaces to look at the status of those trees so that we can report back. So we're going to gather information about the health of our canopy in the open spaces.
Hi, my name is Tim, and I live in the Santa Barbara Shores neighborhood by the Western Northern Grove. And I'm really just concerned about overmanagement of these forests. You know, someone mentioned pedestrian traffic and its effect on the woods. Maybe the compaction of the roots doesn't have much of an effect, or erosion doesn't have much of an effect. But what I do see is in those well-traveled areas, every time a tree falls, it might still be rooted in the ground, and crews are out there within the week cutting it up when that tree could actually regrow from epicormic sprouts, or even just the trunk is still alive and it just grows slanted. And that makes for some of the coolest trees out there. And there are areas, in the areas that are way less traveled, I'm looking at, from your slideshow, those are some of the areas with better canopy cover, and I could show you areas where, or spots where a tree has fallen, a log, and then you've got trees growing out of the log and up. And so that's without management. And then there's, you know, last week, this forest is often characterized as in decline, but there are a lot of areas with all age classes of trees growing from seedlings and epicormic sprouts, and I just want that to be in the discussion and in this, you know, as we talk about this. I watched the meeting online last week, and something struck me, but one thing in particular was Councilman Richards asked the question, you know, there's dead wood in even natural forests all over, and there's been dead wood in these trees for a long time, and I'm surprised at the urgency all of a sudden now. I know there's more, but so anyway, the answer to his question was that, he asked if that dead wood contributes to nutrient levels in the soil, but the answer was no, because this forest was planted and not native. But this is that's what was said. I rewatched it today, and it really surprised me. But this is a naturalized forest. It might have been planted, might not be native, but it, like I said, it's regenerating itself through on many levels. And I don't want us to rush into overmanaging this. And I hear a lot of other people are concerned about that type of thing as well. That's it. So thank you for the presentation. Thanks for your time. And put tags on some of the trees, and like maybe the ones with the vultures on them, are those roosting trees that you actually tagged? There's some tags on some of the trees with notes on them, dated 4/17/2017. Maybe someone else did, but I just wanted to let you know there's more. You might have missed some. Maybe some concerned citizen put those on there. But
I think it was a utility company that did that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, those were actually roosting trees. For the turkey vultures, and
okay.
Then but there's more, so I hope you look further.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak. You all did a very nice job with the analysis, and I'd like to point out here on page 10 of your handout recommendations on restoration, which directly mentioned the habitat management plan. Now, our habitat management plan is, I believe, part of our general plan. It's part of our city's document, which I think we even had a celebration here in the City Hall of our 10-year anniversary here in the City Council chambers. That's how long it's been since this habitat management plan has been getting batted around and nothing's been getting implemented. And I think that's a shame. And I think Elwood Mesa has suffered greatly because of our paralysis. We've painted ourselves into a corner saying, wow, we can't do this because it's an Esha, and we can't do that because it's not a natural tree, and as a result, we haven't done anything. We put up signs and we've invited visitors, but we really haven't taken care of our own home. And I'm really with many neighbors in Goleta who are distressed and sad to see our Elwood eucalyptus forest dying away. And we're questioning whether we should water trees that are still growing? Come on. Really. If we have to move dead logs out of that dying grove, why don't you haul them up on top of the mesa and make some kind of a habitat there instead of chopping them up or taking them off the property? Maybe something useful can be done with those big dead logs. And maybe create some habitat for critters up on top of Elwood Mesa to hide and seek shelter in. But we really need to move ahead and rescue the forest now. There's no time to wait. Venico has been using water at a rate that exceeds anybody in Goleta, and they're shutting down their oil-filled operations. They're probably going to free about 500,000 gallons a year of water. And what's Goleta Water District going to do with it? Who are they going to sell it to? Well, we can't build homes fast enough for that, but maybe we could use just a fraction of that water and put it on our precious community resource and this precious natural habitat. Call it natural, call it unnatural. The monarchs love it. They're here. If you want them for tourists or if you just love nature, I think the clock is ticking. City of Goleta, council members, public works, city manager, get off the stick and implement this habitat management plan that's been sitting on the shelf with a lot of preparation, and it's well worded, but no one has allocated city resources, budget, to hire people who are experts. Experts to the level of our naturalist here, our experts sitting on our panel here, Ann Wells, who's quite knowledgeable in her field and in her department. But the rest of the city really needs to get behind that. It's been 10 years. I'm sorry, but it's late, people. Thank you.
So I think Kevin just made a call out to everybody that we need to work together, and we need to work together quickly. And with the regulatory agencies, and I'm really appreciative that they're here tonight, because we do have our hurdles in front of us when it comes to regulations, environmental review, and those timelines that are involved with all of those things. And the fact that they're here listening to us is really important, because they can hear the urgency of the situation and the need. And but it's how we act and what we do and the timing of that that's going to be the controversy. But as long as we're all talking, we'll get there. But thank you, Kevin.
Hi, my name's Ken Knight. I'm a 34-year resident of Goleta and a registered consulting arborist. So that makes me a tree expert. But I'm not a eucalyptus expert. And there's people who are far better at that than I. Nobody in this room probably is as good as Dr. Matt Ritter. Hopefully he'll be involved in this as well. A couple observations. One, are we trying to develop a habitat for butterflies? Or are we trying to keep it open as a park? Because the two are not necessarily compatible. A park obviously has people in it. If you look at it from a risk assessment, a tree risk assessment standpoint, and I've done thousands of tree risk assessments, you've already solved the problem by cordoning off the area. There are no dangerous trees as long as there's nobody for those trees to fall on. So that's a decision you have to make. If we're going to mix people and trees, you're taking a wild area and trying to redo a wild area, which leads me to my second observation, which is restoration takes a long time, particularly with trees. Best time to plant a tree? 20 years ago. If you're going to be dealing with restoration, the efforts really should be with sustaining existing trees right now, because that's what we want to deal with. And restoring is going to take a long time. And even so, if you want to restore, perhaps you can restore in another area as opposed to this. Which leads to my third point, which is the commitment to do this. Now, several people brought up water issues and money, and we've seen management of other urban forest areas in the city, such as Stowe Grove, which is really difficult to do because it's really difficult to get enough water on those redwoods. And if water is an issue here, is the commitment here and the money to do this at the sake of, you know, we talked about taking the lessons learned here and putting them in other parks, but what we might do is actually put all of our money here and not have any available for other areas. So some of those things to take into consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to address one comment that you made or was a little bit of a question about eucalyptus and butterflies and what are we managing this for? And that's our general plan. So the fact that we've got eucalyptus canopy that's supporting monarch butterfly, that's in our, from our general plan, saying we are to protect that habitat. So that we have some clear guidance about the protection of monarch butterflies in our general plan.
My point was, you can protect the habitat for the monarch butterflies without people tromping around underneath looking at them.
That's one opinion.
Well, and just to add something to that is the current conditions out there, one of my concerns is tree falls taking out other trees. And so that's a situation where just roping it off wouldn't prevent the degradation of the habitat further, I'm afraid. So that's one of the considerations we're really looking at carefully is if, you know, what's the probability of these large trees falling and taking out other trees and further degrading the aggregation sites. So, yeah.
Hi, my name is Kathy Gayden, and I live on Pebble Beach Drive on the west side in the North Grove. And when I look at the infrared picture, or whatever that's called, you can see that that's one of the hardest hit spots. And maybe that has to do with more activity that's been built and exists around it now that maybe wasn't there 10, 20, and so on years ago. But I see when I look out my back door that there's a lot of bald space that wasn't there 10 years before, and a lot of what I'm assuming are zero trees. And I'm a little confused. Are the zero trees going to be taken out before September 30th? Is that the plan?
Well, there's no designation as far as when those trees are going to come out yet. We don't know. A lot of that's depending on decisions that are made and regulations. The zero trees, if they're... What we're doing now is assessing which ones are risk to the public. Mm-hmm. What are going to cause damage if they fall?
I guess one of my concerns with doing that is I understand that and I really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. If you take a lot of those zero trees out, I can already see the change it's made with the light and just the temperature even. And I wonder if we have to take them out before September 30th. But then you can't plant something for a year or more down the road. Does that change the microclimate in that North Grove, and will it become more difficult to establish new growth?
Mm. Yeah, that's a good question. You know, some of that goes to the amount of shading and protection that the dead trees actually provide, which compared to the full canopies is a fraction. So as far as habitat value, you know, they're not... There's a certain amount of biomass there that has some effect, but compared to a canopy of a full tree, it's certainly a small percentage of that. So, you know, that's a good question to consider. I think that the hazard trees, ones that are likely to fall down and take out live trees, it would be important to remove. And then the ones that are a public safety issue, that's the rest. In a lot of those areas in the middle of the Elwood North site, you know, some of those trees can fall down and not either do great damage to the aggregation site or fall in a house. So in those cases, those are not under consideration for removal right at this point. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Cherie. I work with the Santa Barbara Audubon Society. And I'd like to thank you for all of the care and science that went into this presentation tonight. I have what's kind of a nuts and bolts question, and it may be either for Ann or for Vito. Oh, actually, before I ask the question, I'd also like to thank you for the sensitivity to bird nesting season and the timing of the tree trimming and the selection of the trees. My question is, I'm wondering, what is the influence on the extent and timing of the tree removal and the tree trimming of the insurance and risk management requirements? How is that influencing this project?
Todd Mitchell is here. He's our risk manager, and so I think he is the best person to respond to your question. Thanks, Cherie.
Hi, thanks for your question. That was regarding how is the risk management or the liability aspect of this, how is that affecting the timeline? Is that... Well, I think you've all heard it here tonight. One of our primary objectives here is to preserve public safety. We recently had a site visit on the Elwood Mesa with a representative from the CJPIA, our Joint Powers Insurance Authority, and walked through and specifically to get his guidance and some recommendations on how we should proceed with this. You know, now that we're aware of the issues out there and the serious nature of the dead trees and what the potential for liability from falling trees is. Now that we're on notice with that, the city has a duty to act on that. So that's kind of primary from a risk management perspective, is taking care of these dead trees, any trees that are in an area where they could potentially fall over trails or onto somebody using the trails, or kind of secondary to that, trees that could fall into other trees that could then fall into trail areas or places where the public access. So, initially what we want to do is get rid of those dangerous trees, the dead trees that are posing an immediate danger. And then, like Ann has mentioned and the others have mentioned, work on a habitat management plan to take it forward from there. So I hope I answered your question.
Hi, I'm Craig Wakamia. I live at the end of Daytona, so my house actually backs up to the forest there. I appreciate all that has been planned thus far. Because of where I live, I have great concerns about the safety issues, especially with the dead trees and the fallen trees. With there's so much dead trees out there, so there's a huge fire potential. There are probably a few trees that are dead that can probably reach and fall down and probably take out part of my property, structures that are on my property. I'm also concerned about the dead trees that are fallen inside the creek bed and potentially creating a flooding issue there as well. So I have expressed concern to the city in the past about clearing out part of the creek just because of the dead trees and the flooding issues, but also because of the fires. In the 30-plus years that I've lived in that neighborhood, we've actually had two fires directly behind my house. So I would urge removal of the dead trees just to remove the mass. So you're right. If you have no people, there's a safety issue. You remove the safety issue in terms of the trees falling on them, but that still doesn't address the fire issue. Anyway, thank you.
Appreciate your input there. As you can see, there's a, and as you've heard, there are a lot of competing priorities and competing interests on this, and we're trying to, take the best path forward that hopefully can accommodate, most of these objectives and still preserve the habitat there. So you've expressed something that keeps me up at night too. So believe me, I'm just as concerned as you are with this, and I want to make sure we do this right. So thank you.
Yeah, this might be part of the question or what the statement that he made. Do you guys have any need to remove already fallen trees? Because they've been there for a while.
No.
No.
That's awesome.
That's what I want to hear.
Before we take the next question, we have 5 more minutes in the council chambers. We have specific time allocated to this meeting for the televised nature of the meeting. So just a couple more questions and then we will wrap up.
Hi, my name is Mary. I live close to Elwood Mesa. From everything I'm hearing here, is there a plan to do anything by September 20th, if that's your window that closes, or are we talking down the road because you can't do anything by September 20th?
So your question is about timing. So if we proceed as envisioned, which is only a vision at this point, we would do something in the September timeframe. So that we could abate some of the hazards that are out there. But we have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of input to consider tonight and more meetings to follow. But yes, the September is our window that we're looking at to do something, and we'll let everybody know and keep people informed.
Hi, my name is Laura Craig, and most of you have been interested in preserving the grove, which thank you for that. It's one of the treasures of my life. I see that in the week, not even a week, that the signs have been up and the caution tape has been up, it's been knocked over, ripped down, you are not going to stop people from walking out there. So my thought is to our safety person, can you post signs that say, be here at your own risk? When you're on the beach, there is a sign that says, there's no lifeguard available. So if you're going to swim, be aware that you're doing this at your own risk. I don't like being a lawbreaker. I really don't. And I think that it is not healthy for our government to set up a system that pits the people from breaking the law. And I get your liability issues. I get you're trying to protect the city. And at the same time, can't there be something to the first person who said, we're not going to be able to take care of all of these trees at once. Can we at least close a couple of sections or one section where people are actively working rather than closing every single trail except for one? Now, I got to get to work in the morning, so I'm out there at 7 o'clock walking my dogs, and if I'm going to follow your regulations, I can't do what I would normally do and walk and get to work on time. That's not great. And so I find myself breaking the law, or feel like I am, in walking where I've always walked. And for me, it seems like if you are notifying the public, this is an area that is dicey. If you're walking here, you're doing so at your own risk. Let me be responsible for that. Put it in my hands as a citizen. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to sue you because you've already listed this is a dangerous area. You're here at your own risk. It seems like that is not pitting government against the people.
I understand your concerns with the signage out there, and our like I said, our duty is to at least notify the public of what the concerns are. We also don't want to frighten people. It's a serious issue, and hopefully our signs are conveying that. You're describing that you're reading the sign, you understand the nature of what's going on, and you're still walking through it. That's something we can't control, no matter what the sign says. You know, we could tell you that a tree is going to fall on you. You may still choose to walk in. That's nothing we can control. You have your own free will, but at least you're on notice that there's a potential hazard and you're choosing to disregard that. That's the best we can do at this point.
All right, well, 7:29, and I wanted to just make sure that everyone knows how important this is to us to get your input, and that number of you coming here tonight is remarkable, and we know that this is a huge issue to our community, and we're taking it very seriously, and just really appreciate your participation. And please make sure you sign up so that we can make sure you're on our lists, on our mailing list, so we can get information to you. And I see Chris over there with her butterfly. And on that, have a good night. We will do this again. And thank you. Thanks.
Today.